Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. Another exciting night in the Cisco and Falzone Hour, broadcast and politics. We're back again. Tonight we have a special guest, Boots in the Ashes, Busting Bombers, Arsonists. Her name is Cynthia Beach. She is a retired senior special agent with the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol and Tobacco and Firearms, also known as ATF. She'll be here in a couple of minutes. So, exciting show. Can't wait for her to come on. But so many things are happening in the world. But number one topic in the world, unless you're living in a cave and you have not had any contact with anyone, but at least if you do, have a distance of 6 feet. You know, we have this social distance that now we are applying, or we're trying to apply. So just tell your hubby or girlfriend that, or your wife, that for the meantime, you're going to have to sleep in separate quarters because the coronavirus is attacking everywhere. That's trying to be somewhat sarcastic. But what's not sarcastic, what's not funny, is the fact that today 427 individuals died in Italy, which brings the count to 3,405. That's outrageous. They have overtaken China, but again, we know that China doesn't really provide the real actual records, numbers of people, because they're a communist country. So I would say that the situation in Europe is at a crisis mode. I mean, the WHO, which is the World Health Organization, declared that we are in a global pandemic, and which I truly believe, because as many folks that keep constantly saying that we're, you know, this is just the flu. Well, the flu has never shut down governments. The flu has never shut down borders. The flu has never shut down sports events. I mean, tourism. This is a very unusual virus, and it's having a global impact. Schools are closed. The state of Kansas just closed school for the rest of the year. In San Francisco, good old liberal utopia of the world. Well, one of them. Again, trying to be sarcastic here. For 3 weeks. You get to stay home and watch Hulu and Netflix because you can't go out. You could order, they'll bring it to you, but unless you're an essential worker, you get to stay, keep your ass home. Eat on that popcorn and eat and use your toilet paper at the same time. For those who actually have a lot of toilet paper in their homes. Now, the latest statistics is we have 220,000 people that have been confirmed with COVID-19, the more refined way of saying coronavirus, because people get confused with the Corona beer. Unbelievable. Why would you consider and confuse coronavirus with Corona beer? But hey, some people do. 84,000 have recovered. Miracle. 8,000 have died. So that's the latest report. And I know we are involved in this media frenzy with media hysteria. But I think Donald Trump is doing a great job. I think the Republicans are doing a great job. I think overall, I'm glad that the Congress was able to go ahead and take care of some of the stimulus packages for individuals. I think that's going to help us at the end, and the American people will basically be very, very happy once our economy is booming. But I would say that we are in a lot better shape than a lot of these countries, and I think we will make it through. I mean, I know we will, because we are a resilient culture. Anyway, let me bring on Cynthia B. She should be coming on right now. Hold on.
Hello?
Cynthia, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Well, I'm glad. I have to extend my appreciation for you taking your time to come on our show tonight on the Cisco Falzone Hour. My co-host is not available tonight, but I'll be taking the whole show and running with it. So I'm glad you're here. And welcome. Can you give us a little synopsis of your background? I basically gave you an introductory of what you have done, but maybe you can extend it more.
Okay. I didn't hear
I thought you were – okay. So basically I said that you're basically a retired senior special agent with the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, and you spent 27. So anything else that the audience would be interested in knowing about you?
Okay, and then quick question. Are we going to be on live or is this being recorded?
No, we're live. We're live on the air.
Sorry. Oh, my mistake. Yes, I investigated bombings and arson and a lot of gun cases. And I wrote my book is primarily about bomb and arson cases and serial bombers and the Hell's Angels and murder. I had an interesting career. I was one of the first women to be a federal agent, a female ATF agent, and one of the first agents at all who was in a bomb and arson group. But I also lived through an unusual time of history, which is right as the laws were changing and women were being hired, I came on the job. And so I was one of the first to do quite a few different things. I was the first woman to be Top Gun at the ATF Academy, for example.
Fantastic. And how did you get involved? I mean, when you were in high school, did you have an idea that you wanted to go into law enforcement? Or was it something that just came out of nowhere and you said, okay, you know, how did that start? How did Cynthia say, well, I want to go into law enforcement. I want to be the first woman, or did it just happen by coincidence?
More by coincidence in the sense that when I was in high school, there really weren't any women police officers and women federal agents. So it really wasn't something that I could aspire to. And then I studied English literature in college, and I have a master's in journalism. But by the time I was in my mid-20s, federal agencies and police agencies were starting to hire women more, or at least a little bit. And I ended up hearing that the FBI was hiring women. And I looked into that. And to make a long story short, instead of the FBI, I ended up with ATF. But it was basically being in the right place at the right time.
Got it. And how was it, how were you treated initially, since at that time, I'm assuming that at that time, there were very few women that were in ATF, very few women in law enforcement. So how were you received by the male-dominated ATF?
Well, when I first came on the job, my office was all white men. I was the only woman in the office for a time. As an agent, there were women secretaries. And I was very fortunate in that my supervisor had a very good supervisor who was well-respected by all the other guys. And he believed that women should have the right to be agents. And because he was such a good supervisor and so well-respected, that made it much easier for me. There were still some men who didn't believe at all that either women or minorities should ever be federal agents. I had two different men very politely tell me that women could never succeed as agents. But
wow.
Most of the guys really, yeah, they sat me down and they said, look, white men will never listen to women or minorities, and you don't belong here. But happily, they were wrong. So,
so you didn't fit the boys club type, definitely.
Right. So you know, yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
No. I was just gonna. I mean, it's that macho. All style mentality. I mean, because, you know, what a lot of these men don't, they forget is that it was a mother that went through eight, nine months before they gave birth, you know, and I always love, I mean, I love my mother, I love my father, but I love my mother also a lot because, hey, she put up with me for 9 months, you know, and then after that.
So,
I don't know.
I couldn't have said it any better.
So I definitely I always consider myself a very a modern man, you know, because it's definitely not, I don't have that mentality that, you know, women cannot do this. Women are smarter than men in a lot of ways, and I have a great admiration for women, and at all levels. You know, one of the things that I follow, I do some private investigations too. So not at the ATF level, but more on the insurance fraud level. And the investigation fascinates me. And I'm also, I know you've been on 48 Hours and different mainstream media settings. And one of the things that fascinates me is just the way the process of investigation. I think one of the cases that really fascinates me and still does is the Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber. The Unabomber.
Yeah.
How does if you're sitting there and you're profiling someone who's like Ted Kaczynski, how do you come down to the conclusion? You know, what is the type? You know, this picture, this profile of what. A bomber is.
That's a very good question. It's a little bit of a complicated question. I'll be brief though. Initially, when you're searching for a serial bomber, you look at how he, and they're virtually all men, how he builds the bomb, because it has its own signature, and that will reveal to you quite a bit about his background. What techniques does he know, for example, on building a bomb? But also you look at his targets and you do your best to try to figure out his motivations. So you're building from the ground up, from the bomb, from the targets, and you see where that leads you.
Right, but I think in the case, and correct me if I'm wrong, with Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, this was an individual that was not, I mean, he came from a very good background, you know, upper middle class, went to good school, and then, you know, from the transition from that type of individual, a good upbringing, to living in a cabin in the middle of Montana, in the middle of the woods in Montana, it totally, you know, it just blows me away, that whole transition. How he went from one extreme to another extreme.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I don't write about him in my book, so I do know about that case, but I haven't looked into it for quite a few years, so I don't. I'm a little hesitant to tell you about him per se, go ahead.
No, you can go with one of your cases. In the book, yeah.
Well,
if you want.
I had one serial bomber who, thankfully, we caught him before he could continue on to become a type of perhaps a Unabomber type. And he turns out he was diagnosed later as paranoid schizophrenic. He was also quite bright. Now, I don't want to say it. I'm not trying to say that all serial bombers are paranoid schizophrenic. I don't mean that at all. All I'm trying to say is, sometimes there are perhaps first of all, to be a serial bomber, you've got to be off anyways. But there are usually some kind of a mental disturbance. Let me put it that way. That's probably not the correct medical term, but I don't know the correct medical term. But some kind of a mental aberration that would cause anyone to do this in the first place.
Right. Some traumatic experience. That could also, in my opinion, and I'm not a doctor, but I would think that traumatic experience may change the way someone's personality and mental stage may lead them to go in a different direction.
It certainly can. And in every case, each bomber or defendant, whatever the crime might be, you know, you have to look at them as an individual. Because, you know, everyone has their own story, and that's a big part. You were talking about the process of investigation and so on.
Right.
That is a big part of the investigation, is trying to figure out the bad guy's story. Sometimes you know who it is, and as an investigator, and the issue isn't who committed this crime. It's proving. You know who it is, and you just have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's actually fairly common, where all the evidence is pointing to a certain suspect, but you don't yet have proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's quite often the investigations that take a long time, because you know it's John Doe, and you just have to keep accumulating enough evidence, because proof beyond a reasonable doubt is a very high standard, as it should be.
Right.
It's not all that common to have a case where you really, as an investigator, you have absolutely no idea who committed a crime or why. That's actually not very common in my experience. I don't think I came upon those cases more than a handful of times. Usually, whether the motivation is money, that's a very common motivator, or hatred, or revenge. There's usually a tie to a serious crime. I'm not talking about a petty crime, but to a serious crime, there's usually a tie that you can find.
Right. Are we seeing less types of Unabombers now than we did during the 60s and the 70s, during the hippie revolution and into the weather underground? Let me see. I was a kid, but I still remember hearing my dad talking about it, where we had the Symbionized Liberation Army, all these underground anti-government forces. You know, then we had Branch Davidians in Waco, Texas. I've noticed that we're not hearing or seeing. Is that because it's not as important, or what? The trend has changed, because in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, you would hear more about it. What's your take on it?
Well, that's a good question. And no, trust me, those groups are still out there. And maybe right at the moment, there isn't one particular group that jumps to the public's mind. But, underground organizations like you're talking about exist all over the country. And our job as federal law enforcement is to try to stop them before they commit serious crimes. And we do keep track of them, and not just ATF, but state and federal, state and local agencies try to keep track of these organized groups that are intent upon committing serious crimes. It's a constant battle. We're constantly working on accumulating information and trying to stay a step ahead of them, and we cannot always succeed. There's larger groups like the Weather Underground, like you were saying, and the Symbionese Liberation Army, and then there are individuals, you know, like you were talking about with the Unabomber. And those are usually quite different mindsets. But the groups, they are out there. So I don't want people to think that they have gone by the wayside. They are out there, and we are working on them, and we stay on top of them.
Okay, yeah, it's definitely. I mean, we had also it was in New York. I'm from New York City, and what was his name? I can't think of his name, but it was in the 70s, and he was basically, he was a serial killer too. And really, Son of Sam, correct.
Yeah.
And that was,
yeah,
that was another.
David Berkowitz was his name.
Was ATF involved in the David Berkowitz, Son of Sam case?
Wow. I that was long before I became an agent, and I don't know,
okay,
not that I know of. I just happened to be familiar with that case a little bit, and I remember it. I do remember that, you know, obviously that terrified New York City for months and months and months, and as it should have. But I never, as far as I know, ATF was not part of that case. But that was, again, that was long before my time.
Right. Okay. Let's move on to gangs. The ATF, the role of ATF with gangs also, it's similar, or is it a different approach with major gangs? We got the low-level gangs, and then we have the major gangs. I mean, from the Hells Angels, I consider the Hells Angels like top of the gang level,
mm-hmm,
like tier one,
mm-hmm,
tier
yeah,
one. And then we got tier two and tier three, which was probably the Bloods and the Crips, Latin Kings, and then some of the white supremacy groups. Where does ATF look at as a priority? Which has a higher priority? The Bloods and the Crips, or the Hells Angels and the Bandidos and some of these biker gangs?
Well, there's no strict protocol. There's no ranking. For example, let's just say the Hells Angels might be more active, let's just say, in the San Francisco Field Division, and the Crips and Bloods more active in the Chicago Field Division, potentially. But that is one good thing about federal agencies. There tend to be enough agents that we can have active investigations into most, if not all, of these gangs at any one time. They ebb and flow in terms of their violence at any one time. Quite often the gangs collapse from within for a time. In other words, there'll be people within the gang who want to challenge the president, and so the gang itself will go into turmoil for a while, and they will be less effective, less damaging to the public, I guess is a better way to put it. And then they might spring back with a vengeance. So their danger kind of changes depending on where they are and who is in command of any certain gang at any certain time.
Right, right. They're like the terrorist groups. They basically don't. There's no chain of command. They're basically cells all over, so this way if one gets knocked down, it doesn't impact the whole gang. So it makes it even more challenging for law enforcement, especially ATF, right?
Well, yeah, ATF is tasked with fighting violent crime in general. I mean, that is far and away our biggest goal, is to fight violent crime. And that's done primarily through gun cases and gangs, and then also with bombings and arson investigation. And gangs in general have splintered more than they were, for example, 20 years ago. They did have some kind of a structure more 20 years ago. And what happened is younger gang members got tired of working so hard for so little pay to go to the bosses, and they started to branch out on their own. And so then they started to fight from within. And
right,
so there's no longer these really large, or there are very few of these really large gangs with almost a military-style command nowadays. they're broken up into smaller units.
Got it. Now, does ATF get involved? Because we had a guest here a couple of weeks ago, and she indicated that, you know, she worked in the correctional facilities in one of the East Coast states, and that the gangs are very, very involved in the prison system with drugs. Does ATF tackle that, or is that totally not in their jurisdiction or specific goals of gangs?
That's usually prisons are generally speaking handled by the Bureau of Prisons. We do keep up to date on there definitely are gangs in prisons, and they have their own language. For example, we would once a year or so we would be brought up to date on the language and the lingo and the that gangs were using in the prison at any one time, because we would then see them on the streets.
Right.
So particularly people who were gang experts had to keep up with that, and they did. But generally speaking, the Bureau of Prisons handles people who are currently inmates.
Right. So ATF doesn't tackle any issues with gangs running selling drugs and within the prison system?
No. Now, there, I suppose there might be once or twice I did interview guys who were already in prison, and they had information primarily on gun cases that were going on that they had known about before they went into prison. But no, ATF in general does not handle prisoners and their crime, and certainly not drug crime. I mean, we do work drugs as long as it's in conjunction with guns, but drugs on their own, that's usually either DEA or a different agency.
Right. So, okay. It appears that a lot of these gangs, the biker gangs, they're into trafficking meth. Is that something that you guys get?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Well, yes. And it's, I did several investigations on that. And you're absolutely right. They are big into meth and trafficking meth. And it's a very dangerous thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing is, I think there's a connection between now the bikers, like the Hells Angels and the Bandidos and all that, with building that relationship with the Mexican cartels, the different cartels out there. So when would ATF step in to confront these highly sophisticated organizations like the cartels?
Well, certainly in any investigation where guns and weapons play a significant part, we can get involved at any point, and we often do. Usually, if it becomes, unless it's strictly guns, if it becomes a larger investigation and it's a large narcotics cartel, we often will end up working that with another federal agency or the state and locals, you know, whether it's DEA or if you're in California, the California State Police. Quite often, big cases do end up as part of a task force. Not always, but we can become involved anywhere we find guns or bombs or anything like that. So we can step in when it's just one biker, you know, illegally selling a firearm or illegally buying a firearm, and then that can grow into a large trafficking case, firearms trafficking case, for example.
Right.
So we can get in there anywhere along that pipeline there, and we do.
That's interesting. That's interesting. Now, this whole I don't know if you were retired already or you were still when this happened during the Obama administration, the Fast and Furious, where they found a lot of weapons that were being trafficking to the cartels in Mexico. And under, I think it was under, Eric Holder. And a lot of the Mexican government and even the Mexican people were saying, listen, all these weapons are basically American-based, American-made, and they were, you know, they're responsible for the numerous multitude of killings in Mexico. How would that happen?
Well, I do know about Fast and Furious. I mean, I know of it. I was an agent at the time. It was out of the Phoenix office, and I was in Chicago at the time. I don't know about it personally. I do know that it was heavily investigated by Congress. I can tell you, without a doubt, it was at its core, it was meant to be. No one intended for it to end up the way it did. It was not people who ran the operation were trying to do the right thing. It didn't end up being that way, but it's not their motives were trying to do the right thing. They ended up using the wrong means to execute it, but it wasn't meant to end up the way it did.
I don't fault the agents, even the ATF or any law enforcement. I think that was more of a I would come down more on that administration that basically allowed that to happen.
Well, it was very unusual. Even in Chicago, I was very busy at the time. I remember that I was working very hard on other cases, and even hearing about it in Chicago, it was confusing to us because it wouldn't have happened in Chicago. And one of the reasons was what's unusual about Phoenix, or was unusual about Phoenix, was how quickly agents could potentially get to a gun store when they knew that guns were being sold and so on. Phoenix was an unusual city at the time, and in terms of the state law, I don't remember all the details, so I don't want to give your listeners the wrong impression. I'm really
right.
Just going on what I remember from quite a few years ago, but it was the whole setup was unusual. Everything about it was quite odd, and it was not the way that we normally conducted business. But again, their intentions were good. It just somebody somewhere along the line should have said, you know what, this is just not a good idea. Let's not do this. And that did not happen. So I can't tell you exactly where that was. I just never studied the issue very carefully.
So would you say that it was a mostly a bureaucratic mental lapse, too many loopholes?
Well, I don't want to accuse, people remember all the details.
It's not accusing. It's basically, I'm just saying, without accusing anyone, that since these agencies are so big, there tends to be too much red tape or sometimes no red tape. I mean, how did the communication between agencies, I mean, there's been some blame made after 9/11 that, the FBI didn't talk to the CIA and the CIA didn't talk to the ATF or DEA. In your experience working in law enforcement, working at ATF, did you find that there's too bureaucratic?
Well, those barriers do exist, but our job, and one of the things I think one of the reasons I had a good career was I was usually able to get through those barriers. It's our job to get past those barriers. So whether you want to call it jealousy between agencies or a lack of cooperation, sometimes that can exist and it does exist sometimes. At other times, we can work together extremely well. And a lot of that comes down to the individual agents assigned to a case. And I can tell you now, again, 9/11 was an anomaly. It was this gigantic case. So I don't want to use it really to compare it to everyday life. But there were even barriers within the FBI where there were FBI agents saying one thing and supervisors weren't listening to them. But that can happen in any agency. That could have happened in ATF or DEA or your local police department. That's just human nature. So, yes, these barriers can exist, much like they do in the military. I've often thought that when people complain about the lack of cooperation amongst federal agencies, for example, it's similar in wartime with the military units. The Army might not want to tell the Navy what they're doing, and the Navy might not want to tell the Air Force or whatever. But eventually, these things have to get worked out, and usually it's through the command structure. But when I was working a case, I was usually able to break through that by going to individual agents. So if one agent, if it wasn't working for me with one agent, I would find another agent where it would work. So
right.
It was my job as an agent on my case to find an answer, and I was good at doing that. And that's why I was able to make as many cases as I was, because I just didn't let that stand in my way. I would go around that person or those people, and if I had to go to another agency to get the answer, I would do that. And that's our job. That's what we're supposed to do. And I'll be perfectly blunt with you. The more important the case was, the more I would push. If a case really was basically trivial or relatively unimportant, I guess that's a better way to put it, not trivial, but relatively unimportant, I might not fight as hard. I wouldn't necessarily have the time. But, you know, any time where there was murder involved or the potential for people to be killed or it was a major gun case or a major bombing, I was tireless, and I would not stop until I could get past those obstacles, and I did. And that's our job. That's what we're supposed to do.
Right. But it also appears to me from the outside that politics mm-hmm. plays a huge role in a lot of these decisions. Would you agree or would you disagree? I mean, that tends to be another obstacle that, you know, the rank and file like yourself and individuals that really have this true love and dedication for their country and for their job, politics gets in the way.
So when you say politics, do you mean internal office politics, or are you talking about
I'm talking about actual directives coming from Washington.
Well, headquarters, you know, headquarters is both the street agents, ally, and I don't know that they're ever necessarily our enemy, but it can be, headquarters can be a challenge, because we might think as street agents, you know, that we need to do something and headquarters might say no, for example.
Right.
On the other hand, ATF, street agents and headquarters within ATF, things weren't perfect, but there were enough good agents at headquarters. Enough, they were bosses, but they'd also been good agents. That much like I was talking about before, you could usually figure out to find, you could find a way to find somebody in headquarters who could get things figured out for you. So not that, you know, you had to play the game if it was important enough. And yes, sometimes the street agents, we would look at directives coming from headquarters and we would say, what in the heck are they thinking?
Yeah.
That did happen. Don't get me wrong. Absolutely. And again, the more unimportant an issue it was, we'd kind of laugh it off if we just kind of thought something was ridiculous and it didn't pertain to cases, for example, or, you know, some ridiculous thing about your car or whatever. It would be like, oh, okay, fine. In the more important cases, usually there was a way to work it so that no matter how high up the chain of command we had to go, we could get what we needed. And I have to say, I certainly didn't. Every boss I had was not a good boss, but I was always able to find a good boss somewhere up the chain when it was important enough.
Right.
And sometimes it took a lot of work.
Yeah, and again, it does happen in a lot of different fields, different careers, but I just think that from some experience that I've had dealing with the government bureaucrats in Washington that it tends to be a lot of, not every case, but there tends to be politics from Washington tends to get involved in some of the decisions that law enforcement tends to make.
Oh, sure. I mean, there's no question about it that you know, the broad spectrum decisions of whether it's ATF or DEA or FBI or whatever, the emphasis on what type of crime that we might investigate can change from one administration to another. One administration might decide we're going to have an all-out push against guns, and another administration might come in and say, hey, we want you to have a major push against crime in large cities. So yes, different administrations absolutely influence the course of our events, but day in and day out, we make gun crimes and bombs and arson crimes. That's day in and day out what ATF does and gang crime.
Got it. Now, how was the, it must be a really, really, you must be really proud of being the first women to earn the coveted Top Gun Award at the ATF Academy, where you later worked as an instructor. That's a very, very special award.
Yeah, I have to say that was quite a fun day. It was not, I didn't expect it, in that we had four or five guys who were really excellent shots, and I was a good shot, and I'd been a very competitive athlete growing up. But we, for example, we had a guy who'd played in the NFL once, and he was a phenomenal athlete. And we had a couple guys who'd been outstanding shooters when they were state and local police officers. And going into that shoot, I remember thinking, whoever was going to win it was going to have to shoot a perfect target, 100 out of 100. And on that, and at the time, we shot what we would now never carry as a duty weapon. We shot little 38 caliber Smith & Wesson revolvers, which is, it's a very fine handgun, but it's really considered underpowered now for law enforcement. Now we carry much larger capacity 40 caliber semi-automatic handguns. But at any rate, we were shooting the six-shot Smith & Wesson revolver, and I knew I was shooting well that day, but I ended up dropping a point or two, and it turns out I won with a 98, and the guys could not have been any nicer. And so it ended up being a very fun day, and I didn't know how they'd take it. Everyone kind of stood around looking at each other. And the one guy who had played in the NFL was kind of the alpha male in our class and a super nice guy. He came up to me, you know, gave me a big hug and a smile and a congratulations, and boom, as soon as he did that, everybody else, you know, followed suit. So it turned out to be a really fun night, and we went to the bar, and I didn't have to buy any beers, and it was fun.
Wow. So now we are facing a crisis that we have not faced when it comes to a global pandemic that the World Health Organization declared a couple of weeks ago. And I'm just curious, what is the role, if any, that ATF plays in a global pandemic?
Well, I know that street, I've talked to a couple agents the last few days, and the street agents have not yet been what we would call called out to do anything or mobilized yet. They have been given some information. But in the end, we're going to have to see how bad this gets, and we're going to have to see how much assistance is needed from federal law enforcement. And if we did get called out to assist, it would be to help maintain public order. That's the bottom line, no matter what your what law enforcement agency you're with the National Guard and so on and so forth, the government has to maintain public order. And it's much easier to maintain public order than it is to restore public order. No one wants to allow riots or looting to happen, for example. And it's much better for our country to have law enforcement, and if need be, the National Guard. I don't think they've been called out in any city yet, but I'm sure they're on the alert. And
well,
just to maintain public order.
Between you and I, it definitely. I totally agree with you, and I think ATF will. They'll definitely have a role. They have to.
Well,
now.
We would assist in. We would not be the lead agency. We would be assigned to. I'm not exactly sure who would be the lead agency. What federal agency would take the lead, because this is such an unusual situation. But we would be assigned. We would take our assignment as street agents, and they would say, we want you to secure a certain location, for example, and that's what our agents would do. Or we want you to help assure safety of a supply line, whatever it might be, for example. And whatever we were assigned to do, we would cooperate at this point. It would all be about cooperation between federal agencies and state and local agencies.
So is that the time when all the federal agencies really come together?
Oh, yeah, they have to. It's not, and it's not a choice. And the issue becomes, who is the lead agency? And how competent are they? And whoever is going to be the lead agency, and I think that really is going to depend on what happens. I think it's going to depend on how bad it gets, is, you know, they have to make sure that each agency knows what their assignments are, and then we, you know, ATF, each agency will be able to execute their assignment. But at that point, we are all in this together, absolutely. Yeah, and without doubt, we will do what we need to do.
Right. So you wouldn't be involved in the actual aspect of you'll be there for basically law and order.
Yes, I would think so. I mean, it would be, again, with the overarching plan, it would be a large scale plan, all based on maintaining public order in wherever agents are assigned to be. So, you know, it's possible that agents could leave a smaller city and be assigned to a larger city for a certain amount of time. And again, I know that there are plans in headquarters. I know there are people working on this and planning it in headquarters. It's not yet on the street yet to the ATF agents, and I don't know if it will be. But if it is, we will absolutely do whatever we are assigned to do and take care of things.
Now, ATF is under the Department of Justice, right?
Yes, now we are, yes. After 9/11, when the Homeland Security Act came into being, we moved from the Department of the Treasury to the Department of Justice. So, and again, this is such an unusual situation. I don't know what the lead agency would be, but every agency,
right,
not just ATF, but every agency will do what they're assigned to do in a situation like this.
And how is that? How is that transition from the Department of Treasury to Department of Justice? Was that a smooth transition, or
yes,
or yeah?
Yeah, for the street agents, you're about the third or fourth person I've talked to who's been interviewed. You've asked that, and for the street agent, it really was almost seamless. I know at headquarters, for them, it was a paperwork pain in the neck, you know. They also started reporting to different people. So they used to report to people at the Department of Treasury. Well, now they reported to people at the Department of Justice. So there were changes to be made in headquarters, but for the most part, for your average street agents, it really didn't affect us too much.
Got it. If you were to advise someone who would be interested in joining law enforcement, and especially the ATF, what would be your recommendation? Just someone coming out of college?
Probably first, you usually need to have a job first before you're hired on with any federal agency. Very rarely will they hire a, what I would consider at this point in my life, a kid right out of college. You usually have to work first, because that way, unless perhaps you've had extensive experience with the military, because you need to have a track record as an
right.
as an adult in employment. But for a young person who wants to come on with ATF,
yeah,
it's a very it's a demanding job. It can be a great job. It can also be a pain in the neck, like any job. You have to be flexible. You have to be willing to work hard if you want to be successful. But it's really very much also about getting along with people and playing to your strengths. So try to, you know, to you know, be willing to learn from other agents who have been around the block. You know, if you want to be an ATF agent, I wouldn't just, I guess I would say, be committed, be ready to work hard, be willing to learn, be flexible, and it can be a fantastic career.
Yes, because it's definitely, I would believe that someone coming out of college who actually has worked and has a career, it would be a step up. Being part of a great agency like ATF or, you know, the FBI or CIA?
Generally speaking, federal agencies are considered the most desirable to work for. They have pluses and minuses, though. We tend to be paid the most, for example, just kind of that's a general statement across the board. I imagine New York City police officers might be more well paid. I don't know that for a fact, but on the other hand, there are drawbacks. You know, as part of a federal agency, you can be transferred anywhere at any time, and you have no recourse. So you might be very happy living with your family in Los Angeles, and you might walk into the office one day, and they said, guess what? Tomorrow, or, you know, in 2 weeks, you have to report and move to New York City. That doesn't happen too often, but, boy, it certainly can happen, and it can happen as a punishment. There are pluses and minuses to federal law enforcement, just like there are to state and local law enforcement. But for me, I liked working the bomb and arson cases the most. I liked the complexity. We have a larger jurisdiction than most state and local agencies do. But I know that there are street coppers who would never have switched. I know there were, you know, for example, some Chicago street coppers who would never have wanted to be a federal agent. They thought, you know, no way.
Well, I think Chicago PD has their hands full already in the South Side.
Yeah, Chicago PD, there's lots of action in Chicago. If you're a Chicago copper, you stay on your toes. There's no doubt about
it. Yeah, definitely. Well, I want to, if you want to give your website, give any and promote your book, which is we'll definitely promote it on this website. Again, let me just, before you do that, we have to basically say that this show is show sponsors by Students for a Better Future, Doreen Ann, who is our show writer, and she's without her we wouldn't have this show. So thank you, Doreen. All right. Cynthia, just go ahead and promote your book and your website, so if anyone is interested, they can go there.
Well, the name of the book is Boots in the Ashes, Busting Bombers, Arsonists, and Outlaws as a Trailblazing Female ATF Agent. And my name is Cynthia Beebe, that's B-E-E-B-E, and that's my website, which is www.cynthiabeebe.com. And my social media is at CynthiaBB4, which is the number 4, at CynthiaBB4. And you can buy the book online through Amazon, at Barnes & Noble's, and it's at Barnes & Noble's bookstores and other bookstores as well.
And by the way, also, I forgot to mention, your cases have been chronicled in the New York Times, Chicago Tribune, Ladies Home Journal, and you've been covering ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, and the Cisco and Falzone Hour, and 48 Hours. So you got a great track record.
Well, thank you.
Definitely. So we just have a couple minutes more to go. How do you see the future of ATF in regards to promoting women, minorities, and just overall the future of the ATF?
Well, there is still it is still a struggle within all federal law enforcement agencies for hiring and promoting women in particular. There was a large report done by the Office of the Inspector General in 2018, so just a couple of years ago, saying that only 16% of federal law enforcement in the Department of Justice agents were women, and of those 16%, they struggled to be promoted, and they there were an unusual number of complaints about, you know, being discriminated against because of their gender. So having said that, 16% is a lot more than when I came on 30 plus years ago, but it is still a battle. And based on the report that did come out by the Inspector General's office, the White House said that they were going to work to try to improve those numbers. So I think it's just going to be a long-lasting process, and it's just something that we will continue to work on over time. And we are getting there, and we'll keep working on it. And that's all, that's true with minorities as well. But there is progress. It's just been quite slow.
So on this show, basically, I try not to get political with some of my guests. But I'm going to try and do it a little bit different today. So of the administrations, in your experience with the ATF, which administration, which party tends to be more favorable to the ATF when it comes to funding and being supportive?
You know,
I don't want to put you in the spot. I don't want to put you in the spot if you don't, but I mean, you don't have to say, you know, did you feel that there was more funding coming during a certain period of time? You can phrase it that way without mentioning.
You know, every different administration, there would be kind of ebbs and flows, but as a street agent, we were allowed to do our work. There was never a time when we did not have the resources we needed to do our work. I never felt, you know, that I couldn't, if I had to fly to another city to do an interview that was crucial to a major investigation, I could get funding. I mean, so for me, affecting my life as a street agent, there was never any certain administration, whether Republican or Democrat, where I felt, oh my gosh, I'm not going to be able to catch this bad guy because, you know, a certain person's in the White House. I never felt that.
Okay.
And I'm sure that, you know, at a much higher level than mine, you know, in the upper reaches of ATF headquarters, of federal law enforcement headquarters, they probably did have a fairly clear-cut idea. But for me as a street agent, I was always able to do my work, and that was important.
Well, I want to extend my appreciation for you taking time to come on the Cisco and Falzone Hour. And we look forward to having you again.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being here. I really enjoyed myself and had a good time. Thank you.
All right. Have a great evening. Cynthia Beebe, author of Boots in the Ashes, Busting Bombers, Arsonists, Outlaws as a Trailblazing Female ATF Agent. Thank you again.
And thank you. Have a nice evening.
You too. So in the meantime, next week we'll have another exciting guest on the Cisco and Falzone Hour, and we'll keep you updated on the latest with the coronavirus. And I think it's going to be a very, very demanding next couple of weeks, but as a country, we'll get through. We're resilient. And we will overcome. God bless America, and we got to stick together because we'll beat the coronavirus. Have a good evening. Good night.